Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Coming up in about 25 minutes, we'll be talking with the first Lutheran missionary sent behind the former Iron Curtain in 1990 about Christianity in the Czech Republic. This pastor was actually there. He didn't know he was going to be there, but he was there for the Velvet Revolution. We'll get that story and his thoughts coming up in about a half hour here on Issues Etc. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Uwe Simonetto is our guest. We're talking about the lay vocation of artist. We're focusing at first on the Christian artist and then on the secular artist. In the very last half hour of Issues Etc. today, Steve Wagner joins us to talk about several stem cell-related issues. There is Senator John Danforth, who has not only been in the ads advocating a measure that would permit embryonic stem cell research, therefore the destruction of human embryos in the state of Missouri. He's also been on television recently outside those ads doing media interviews. We'll have a bit of that. We'll play it for Steve Wagner and get his reaction. We'll also talk about the fraud allegations surrounding stem cell research in South Korea and the stem cell research in California that was promised with a $3 billion referendum to put California on the stem cell map. And not a lot has happened. Not a lot has happened out there on the West Coast. We'll find out why with Steve Wagner of Stand to Reason in the last half hour of the program. Uwe Simonetto is our guest. He's an international journalist, a resident scholar, and director of the New Concordia Seminary Institute on Lay Vocation and director of the Concordia Center on Religion and the Media. Uwe, before the break, you were about to tell us something you remember about the vocation of the Christian artist and the state of art, Christian art, nowadays. I think we just lost Uwe. We'll get him back here in just a moment. Our call-in numbers in the meantime, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org, issuesetc@kfuo.org. When we're done talking with Uwe in about 20 minutes, we'll be talking about the Czech Republic, and then we'll also, as I said before, be talking about stem cell-related issues. I heard the audio from Jack Danforth that was on one of the local television stations here, and he just flat-out said he thinks that this initiative and then the referendum that's coming up next November in Missouri is pro-life, even though the initiative very clearly does not ban human cloning, but allows human cloning in Missouri for the express purpose of doing research on the embryos that are the product of that cloning and thereby destroying those human embryos. Even though there's no distinction made in the ads that are for the referendum between adult stem cells, for which there are no ethical problems, and embryonic stem cells, for which there are nothing but ethical problems. He still thinks it's pro-life. He has no problem with calling this thoroughly pro-life. One of his thoughts there, I paraphrase, but just barely. He thinks it's very pro-life to use any measure, any medical measure necessary to save lives and to bring people cures. Any? Really, any? That's a pretty broad statement from the former senator. We'll get Steve Wagner's response to that coming up in about an hour here on Issues Etc. I think we have Uwe back now. We're talking about lay vocation and the secular artist. Still on the subject of the Christian artist, Uwe, before the break you were going to tell us something you remembered. You were answering a question about the state of Christian art today.
Well, I said the state of Christian art is actually not bad. There's some very, very good stuff coming out, and they are very good. Nowadays, once again, you have good church architecture. The worst bit of Christian art, I think, is over. Other than what you would call sort of popular Christian art, which unfortunately has even entered the liturgical churches like ours, where instead of singing a full theologically quality hymn, you keep repeating just verses of verses of verses to the tune of elevator music, and that I think is disastrous. And the problem is really that that we do not no longer educate children to appreciate good art.
Someone will say, look, I don't want my kid to turn out to be an artist of any kind, because they generally tend to starve or live off their parents for a long time.
Yeah.
But if they're going to, as a Christian, then at least their art should be a witness. It should have some explicit religious content to it as a Christian. Is that necessarily true?
No, you can see it that way. Then you'll have to say, okay, my kid should only be an artist in the right-hand kingdom and should only be producing church art. And then you're leaving out all the wonderful things that an artist can do for everyday life. It's like saying, I want my kid to be a pastor. I don't want him to be a doctor or a dentist. So what do you do with all those poor people who were in pain and need looking after out of love? This is the art has the phenomenal quality of spanning the two kingdoms, spanning the secular and the spiritual, and bringing beauty into the secular realm. And if you do this, you very much act in the image of God, if indeed it is positive art, if it is art produced out of love. The very interesting thing is that that the beauty of the universe, which scientists discover more and more and more and more, leads many of them, especially as cosmologists, back to faith, because they say only God can produce anything as beautiful as the universe. So the artist, therefore, producing beauty for the secular realm as much as for the spiritual realm, is acting as God's cooperator, and he brings joy into the world, not necessarily into worship, although this is of course very important. As a long-time lover of the music of Johann Sebastian Bach, obviously I highly appreciate that, but there's other wonderful music that is secular and that is still beautiful and still being produced by people acting according to their vocation, their divine vocation.
What about art? You just alluded to this a moment ago. Art that does not, I mean, it's not a question of good art or bad art, but it's a question of art that either serves the neighbor in love or does not. Can you give us some examples in the realm of the art that you think where artists, secular or Christian, violate their vocation by producing art that does not serve the neighbor in love?
Well, let's take the secular ones. I would say that, for example, the rap music such as produced by Eminem, the rap star, violates the calling. It has its own aesthetic quality, but then Lucifer has his own aesthetic quality. Evil has an aesthetic quality, but it is negative art. It destroys rather than builds up. It gives you a grin at best, rather than a cheerful smile that you would get if you went to this play that I referred to earlier in the show, or for example, into an art exhibition that I saw in Washington just before leaving Washington, featuring the mobiles of Alexander Calder and the wonderfully witty paintings by Juan Miró, and everybody leaving that show left with a smile, a happy smile. It doesn't all have to be done for worship. The Bible itself tells us to enjoy our lives in this world here, not just make it a grim adventure. And so therefore the artist making us happy, bringing us joy, is doing a work of love for us, and that is willed by God.
We talked about the vocation of the journalist, and then as the consumer of the news. Let's talk about the other side of this just for a moment. Not only the person who produces the art, but also, say, a person who patronizes the arts, or who by by, you know, kind of consuming the art, if there's got to be a better word than that, but
yeah.
by observing the art or taking part
receiving
in
it.
Receiving it also has a role to play. Talk about both of those.
Well, a very important role, and I'm going to make lots of enemies this evening, but I do actually believe that people who do not make the effort to understand and appreciate art, you don't have to be a great fan of cubism or I don't know, surrealism, you can love other stuff. It doesn't matter. I mean, there's taste involved here. But if you don't make the effort of appreciating art, of learning about art, then you are actually failing in your duty to your secular calling as a receiver of beauty. If you just want to, it's sort of, you know, like somebody who only drinks sloppy syrup the whole time, or drinks Coke all the time, rather than other wonderful beverages, or who eats nothing else but hamburgers, and then says, well, this is good enough for me, because that person may not ever have been taught to appreciate a wonderful sit-down dinner, a wonderful meal prepared by loving hands. We are getting into another field, and that's the calling of parents and teachers and pastors to train young people, to educate young people to appreciate good art. In my case, I was very, very lucky. My parents took me to concerts as early as my third or fourth year. A very, very young kid, I went to the Thomaskirche in Leipzig and learned about Bach, and then from then, of course, learned a lot about other art forms as well, architecture, painting and sculpturing, etc. But the worst thing that I find nowadays, and that refers, of course, also to the bad church music that we hear so much, is that parents no longer make the effort to teach their children to appreciate beauty, to appreciate something that has been done out of love for them. But this goes then again, Henning Glapp, I've been in several colleges now, when children are not raised to sit up straight at table, so they gobble down grub with plastic forks and with one shoulder under the plate and the other elbow leaning on the table. Well, what it means that they've never been taught to respect something. Cooking is also a form of art, something that has been prepared for them out of love. And I think there is an enormous responsibility that Christians have and have to reconsider in all these realms that have to do with creativity, be it good architecture, be it good painting. We're not discussing individual styles, as I said earlier on, the styles, beauty is in the eyes of the beholder. But there is beauty there that you have to learn to appreciate in all these art forms, and that is the responsibility of those who educate children.
There was a time, I think, at least in Western civilization, when children were, as a matter of course, taught not only to appreciate the fine arts, but also to some degree to train themselves in them, at least in a rudimentary way, not in view of becoming an artist,
no.
but in simply appreciating the art that they would later receive.
Yeah, correctly. I mean, you learned how to play the piano or some other instrument. You learned how to draw. And that is, you know, that was even in my childhood. I mean, we were taught these things so that we could appreciate, that we could also, you know, I still occasionally draw caricatures or do drawings for my wife or somebody, you know, on her birthday or wedding anniversary or something like that. I'm not a genius artist. I'm simply, you know, somebody who's learned to draw and who's learned to appreciate music, give joy to others in my limited way. I think some of the best paintings that I've ever given, best presents I've ever given my wife were paintings that I bought, which she loves so much and we both love. It is a sign of our de-civilization and also our de-Christianization when we dismiss art from the home, the private home, And when people, when parents no longer deem it necessary to teach their children how to sing, how to play an instrument, how to listen to music, when parents themselves don't make the effort to listen to decent music, but just feed on this garbage that comes down the airwaves and comes through elevators and television screens.
One thing that came to mind when I was thinking about our interview here today, Uwe, was the other nefarious ends toward which the artist might put, I mean, he's maybe a decent artist, but he produces art that does not serve the neighbor in love. The most obvious example I can think of perhaps is the filmmaker who produces things that are ungodly, but also art used in the service of propaganda.
Well, listen, the Nazis and the communists were past masters of this. And it's very strange that these propagandistic paintings and sculptures that the Nazis and the communists produced were almost identical. And they had, I don't know whether you would call it beauty. They had a sense, they had aesthetics, but these aesthetics were destructive. They would show you idealized, or in the case of the Nazis, Aryan bodies, you know, muscular guys, square chins, buxom women feeding kings, all that sort of stuff. That's the Nazis. So, which means by inference that anybody who doesn't look like that is, of course, inferior. Whereas a wonderful artist, including somebody like Picasso, portrays all the images. I mean, the whole vast, wonderful variety of nature and human and humans that we have. There is no such thing as ugliness, other than what you create within yourself.
The concept of objective taste. I mean, that's the term that's used.
Yeah.
Good taste seems to have gone by the wayside, replaced by kind of a postmodern egalitarianism in which, you know, people will very commonly say nowadays, there's no distinction between good art and bad art. It's just art, and it's all really a matter of personal preference. There's no objective standard. How do you respond?
Well, this is precisely the same thing as you said. It's postmodernism, the same thing as religion. There is no objective standard. Yes, there is. Of course, there is an objective standard, whether a line is well drawn or whether colors are well chosen, whether the images are pleasing or not. Or to go one step further, because you know somebody who is not trained to appreciate modern art might still say, well. Yeah, but you know there is what about all that destructive stuff? Well, the destructive stuff is not more than art. It's not a wonderful composition of paints and shapes and colors and figures. But destructive art is always something that turns you into a negative being, that makes you angry, makes you. Negative, like Eminem's music. Go through the internet, see some of the art. I mean, you see artwork that shows nothing but death and destruction. And this is not an artwork designed to warn people of war, which is also valid art, often used and misused for propaganda, alas. But this is destructive art because to make you regale in negative images, usually in a perverted sexual form, that you also have.
Finally here, Uwe, there are, I think the case can be made that that Christianity as the impetus for art, both religious and secular, has an edge on many other religions. I'm thinking in terms of Islam. Islam certainly has produced art, but of late, especially with its global bent, it is not an art-producing religion. It does not produce art-producing civilizations either. Your thoughts?
No, Christianity has much wider spread. There has been wonderful Islamic art, especially in architecture. Of course, they were Islam, like Judaism, never produced images, graving images, not human beings. But there has been wonderful Islamic art, but you're quite right. Not only are the Muslims not producing wonderful stuff anymore, but they are actually destroying wonderful stuff. For example, much of the ancient architecture of Mecca and Medina is being destroyed right now by Muslims, by the Saudi government, to be rebuilt and to accommodate more pilgrims and what have you. Christianity has a wider variety, but also Christianity has, like Islam, its wings that are very hostile to art. I mean, you know, you go to many a church where there is no image whatsoever. It's not even a cross, and there are Christian preachers like Rick Warren who say, "Well, rip out your organ. They have served there. They're no longer doing any good," which of course is nonsense. The pipe organ is 3,000 years old, was initially created in Greece, and who is Rick Warren to say, well, rip out the organ and let's strum a few guitars and then just repeat the same cadences over and over and over again and make people happy, hammer a few drums and you're done. That is, so you have this, you go into a wonderful Orthodox church, and you have the magnificent singing, you have the wonderful images there, or in a good Catholic church, or Lutheran church. And then you have other churches, including, for example, Catholic churches, that have totally destroyed their music. Go into a Catholic church nowadays, and the liturgy is often intolerable. It is so bad, you get better music in a bar. That also is a result of the turning what is sacred into something banal, and there's a parallel here between what goes on in the secular realm and what goes on in the sacred realm and in the spiritual realm, and it's very dangerous. And we as Christians should be very, very careful to reverse this, and the only way to reverse it is by making more of an effort to educate our children.
With only 30 seconds here, Uwe, right, what is the artist called to do in his vocation?
To give people joy. The artist's vocation is the imitation of God, is to create beauty. And to create beauty that gives joy as opposed to render you depressed. That is the artist's vocation.
Dr. Uwe Simonetto is an international journalist. He's resident scholar of the and director of the New Concordia Seminary Institute on Lay Vocation, director of the Concordia Center for Faith and Journalism as well. You can read a column by Uwe titled Called to Joy. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, click links on the left-hand side. You will find a direct link to Uwe Simonetto and the Concordia Seminary Institute on Lay Vocation. The website address, issuesetc.org. Uwe, thanks for being our guest.
And Merry Christmas to all of you.
And to you as well.
Thank you.
When we come back from this break, we're going to spend about 25 minutes with a pastor who was the first Lutheran missionary sent behind the former Iron Curtain in 1990. We're going to talk about Christianity in the Czech Republic. We'll begin by getting his story. He was there unwittingly during the Velvet Revolution. That's coming up next. Stay tuned.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
He came not in glory, not to kings and princes. He came in humility to common people. He came to us. These words come from our Issues, Etc. book of the month for December, a beautifully illustrated children's book for Christmas called The Shepherd's Christmas Story. This book tells the story of our Savior's birth from the perspective of the shepherds who witnessed it and then witnessed to others of Christ's birth. You can order The Shepherd's Christmas Story from Concordia Publishing House. It's $12.99 plus shipping and handling. Their number, 1-800-325-3040. Ask for the Issues, Etc. book of the month for December, The Shepherd's Christmas Story. 1-800-325-3040. Or browse before you buy at our homepage, issuesetc.org. Issuesetc.org.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. Sweeping legislation to combat human trafficking unanimously passed the House last week and will soon be heading to the Senate. What's unique about the Trafficking Victims Protection Reauthorization Act of 2005 is its focus on trafficking that starts and ends here in the U.S. There's also money for faith-based organizations that want to help combat the trade. Steve Jordahl reports.
Speak of human trafficking, and most people think of sex tourism in Thailand or forced labor on an African plantation. The tragic truth is that thousands of young girls are taken from U.S. streets and forced into a life of abuse. Bradley Miles is with the Polaris Project.
You have runaway and homeless youth. The numbers of runaway and homeless youth on the streets in the hundreds of thousands all the way up into the millions. And those youth are incredibly vulnerable. The average age of entry into prostitution is 13. So, you know, these are children.
The Trafficking Victims Bill includes what's called end demand provisions, stopping trafficking by stopping the demand, and funds a crackdown on those running the rings as well as those who solicit. Chris Smith of New Jersey sponsored the bill.
Through carrots and sticks, that there's much more vigorous enforcement on the Johns than just on, you know, gathering up prostitutes and then they spend the night in jail, and the next day they're back doing the same thing.
The bill provides $10 million in grants per year available to nonprofit and faith-based groups wanting to fight the trade.
We really have found that the faith-based organizations do extraordinary work on this. The evangelicals, Catholic Charities, for example, and others.
He says it's a ministry more should get involved in. For Family News in Focus, I'm Steve Jordahl.
The Trafficking Victims Protection Act also includes penalties for foreign nationals who engage in the sex trade while under contract with the U.S. government. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Next time on the Bible study, our encounter with the woman at the well in Samaria continues as we finish up John chapter 4. Our guest will be the Reverend Dr. Walter A. Meyer II, professor at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne. John chapter 4, next time on the Bible study. Heard weekday mornings at 10:05.
The Bible study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts, serving God's people.
Popular author Dandy Daly McCall has written our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for December, titled The Shepherd's Christmas Story. It's a Christmas book for young children. The Shepherd's Christmas Story is published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. The cost is $12.99 plus shipping and handling, 1-800-325-3040. Or find out more about The Shepherd's Christmas Story on our website, issuesetc.org. The Shepherd's Christmas Story.
Coming off that conversation with Uwe Simonetto on serving the neighbor through the arts, we dare not forget the more obvious ways of serving the neighbor in love. LCMS World Relief, they underwrite Issues Etc., and they provide Christ-centered, cross-focused relief, concerned for both body and soul, serving the neighbor in love in as diverse a number of ways as you can imagine. You go to our website and you will find their logo and you'll get all sorts of information on what they're doing worldwide, LCMS World Relief. Our website address is issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org, or here at the end of the year, think about a tax-deductible gift to LCMS World Relief. Their number, 1-888-930-4438, 1-888-930-4438, or again, find their logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org. For the next half hour, Pastor Jim Krikova is our guest. We're going to talk about Christianity in the Czech Republic. He was the first Lutheran missionary sent behind the former Iron Curtain in 1990, shortly after the Velvet Revolution in 1989, and he's director of Four Corners Missions. Pastor Krikova, welcome to Issues Etc.
Good evening. Hi.
First of all, it was a pleasure to meet you. I guess it was a couple of weeks ago when you happened in here during one afternoon with Pastor Daniel Preuss, a regular guest on the program.
That's right.
Talk about first you unwittingly finding yourself in the middle of the Velvet Revolution in 1989.
That wasn't really part of my mission. My brother and I had decided to take a trip back to our country, and we're five children in our family, and I was the only one who had learned some Czech from childhood. The rest of the kids had pretty much given it up. And so he asked me to go along with him to translate, and we strolled into Prague on November 16th, and the revolution happened on November 17th. Of course, we didn't really know anything about it, and neither did the people we stayed with. It was a big surprise to everybody, and it was a bit of a scary time because nobody really knew what was going to happen.
What was actually happening? I mean, from your observance and your knowledge of it firsthand there, what occurred there in what is now the former Soviet Union? What was occurring during the Velvet Revolution?
Well, there were some opposition movements, which, of course, we didn't really know about over here, really. I think it took the whole world by surprise, but... I don't know if you're talking about my direct experience when we were out on the street in the upper castle, it was called, part of town. We could hear this big noise, and it sounded like there was a stadium or something. I thought there was a football game or something nearby, and of course it wasn't. It was this million people march to the Wenceslas Square to protest the communist regime. And of course there was a movement, a protest movement in place of people who had signed some protest letters against the government and asking them to step down, and it just escalated, and so that the entire square was full of people and calling for the resignation of the old government, which ultimately did happen, although it took a while.
So give us just a brief history lesson for those of us who have been a bit insulated from the plight of the people in Eastern Europe. What is the most recent history before and then now after the communist domination in the Czech Republic?
What do you mean before?
Well, how long did communism hold sway there?
Oh, yeah. Communism lasted from 1948 until 1989. Really after World War II, when the Americans and the British and the Russians won the war in 1945, then already at that time there were talks between Churchill and Stalin and Eisenhower about how the world would be divided up, and basically Czechoslovakia was going to go to Stalin, and so by 1948 then that happened. And they took over, and it was under communist rule then from 1948.
What was the state of the church during the time of communist domination?
The church was in a really unhappy position. In all of Christianity, you might say, Protestants and Catholics alike, and everybody was under the Ministry of Culture, which was a government ministry or office that oversaw the churches of the country. It's a little bit different than America because America has a separation of church and state, which Europe really doesn't have and hasn't ever really had, and it was no different there. And so the Ministry of Culture oversaw the churches, and they basically dictated to the churches what could and couldn't be taught, and every pastor, whether they were Catholic or Protestant, had to sign a paper promising to teach Marxism in their church in order to be ordained in their church.
What was the nature of that church? I think were the distinctions between various Protestant denominations maintained, or did every church by that kind of you got to proclaim communism kind of get mashed down?
Basically, everybody who would be ordained had to agree to this, and if you didn't agree to it, you were either deported. Some people were lucky enough to be deported, or you were sent to jail, and so you didn't really have much choice. If you wanted to be a pastor, you either had to sign this paper, or take adverse consequences. And so, some people, for the sake of trying to preach some kind of gospel, they would sign the paper. But in the end, of course, it ended up into so much corruption because even some of the very pastors of congregations were actually siding with the communists, and they would even turn their own people in for going to church, and there would be reprisals for that, and people would go to jail, whatever. So it was pretty. The church itself was in a very sick place. It was very, very unhealthy.
What was the effect, as far as you can tell, on church attendance, church going? the general view of the populace toward the Christian message during that time?
During communism, I would say that, you know, church attendance was extremely low. And for those pious believers who wanted to continue to go and did go, they suffered some brutal consequences for it at the very hands of the church itself, or the official church itself. And that, of course, was a big sore spot for people. And so church attendance went way down. People just stopped going because they figured it wasn't worth it. Or if they did believe in, like the most important aspects of the Christian message, like the gospel and the power of the sacraments, like baptism, for example, sometimes they would do crazy little things like, if you were born in this town and you had a child in that town, then you would go to some faraway town and have your child baptized so that the records would be all confused and no one would be able to sort of trace you down.
Was there I know that in a lot of Eastern Europe, there was between Lutherans and other Protestant denominations a union. Was that the case under Soviet domination?
Well, it was the case under Soviet domination, but it came well before that because...
Right.
In 1918, at the end of World War One, under the influence of what was called the Pan-Slavic movement, which started in the mid-19th century, many of the Protestants formed a union church called what's now called the Czech Brethren Church, not the Czech Brethren Church of the 16th century, like we oftentimes think about it in our churches in America or in our seminaries. But the new Czech Brethren Church was a union of four, at least four different Czech Protestant groups, and it was formed on the basis of Slavic unity, not on the basis of any doctrinal unity. And just to give an example, two of the confessions that this union church accepted, one is the Augsburg Confession, which is the Lutheran founding document. And the other is the Helvetic Confession, which is the confession of Calvinism, which is diametrically opposed to the Augsburg Confession. So, but they banded together on the basis not of doctrine, but on the basis of Slavic identity.
Did this further degrade the state of the church during the communist era?
Well, you have to say ultimately yes, because whenever doctrine is is put on the back burner, the church is going to go down no matter what. I guess you almost couldn't blame communism almost for that, because when doctrine is set aside, the church is going to go downhill no matter what other extraneous forces are there. On the other hand, I can tell you that in this particular instance, the prevalent theology that was embraced by the Czech Protestants was the theology of Karl Barth, which was pretty... non-Lutheran and basically reformed in its approach.
After the Velvet Revolution, 1989, did people flock back to churches now that there was no longer any state sanction required of the churches or communist sanction required of the churches?
Yeah, I would have to say that yes, they did flock back to the churches, and people were baptized and took instruction and were baptized in droves at first. And it tended to be sort of a big wave at the beginning, and then it sort of leveled off as a lot of these people who came to the church at first came there because it looked like a piece of liberty to them, and so they thought, well, during communism we weren't really allowed to be religious or to be Christians, and so everybody wanted that. Well, as soon as the sort of as soon as that sort of wore off, then people tended to drift away. So there was a big wave at first, and then it sort of declined, and now kind of a leveling off.
Given the doctrinal confusion before and then even after the fall of the Soviet Union, how difficult is it now to enter the mission field there with the distinctly confessional and Lutheran message?
Well, it believe it or not, it works pretty well. first of all, Lutheranism thrived in the Czech Republic, or I'm going to say Bohemia, which is really the western part. But Lutheranism thrived in Bohemia among the Czech people from about 1520 to 1620, and that 1520 to at least the end of the century, that was really the Lutheran era, and And 1620 marks kind of the beginning of, or the end of the 30 Years' War for the Czech people, when they were defeated by the Roman Catholic armies. And a lot of the leaders were hung on the Old Town Square and so on. But there was 100 years of good, solid, confessional Lutheran theology that is now viewed as part of the history of these people. And so now, even in the 20th century, even though a lot of, you know, liberalism has crept into the church, or you might say doctrinal indifference, and then, of course, the repression of Christianity through the communist era, we are viewed as a piece of their history, and so people are certainly willing to give us a hearing. In fact, even the other churches around us view us as a breath of sort of fresh air in a kind of external way, because they view us as a piece of their history coming back to life.
We're talking with Pastor Jim Crick of about Christianity in the Czech Republic. He was the first Lutheran missionary sent behind the former Iron Curtain in 1990. He's director of Four Corners Missions. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. So, name the factors. What is the biggest challenge or set of challenges in doing mission work in the Czech Republic?
Well, I think that always one, I would say that the big challenge is to be the Christian church, to be recognizable as the Christian church, to not be viewed as a sect like the Jehovah Witnesses or the Mormons or something like that, but to be viewed as true Christianity, but not to be viewed as a tyrannical Christianity. And of course, since the Battle of White Mountain at the end of the 30 Years' War for the Czechs, anyway, which was at the beginning of the 30 Years' War actually, but when the Czechs were defeated in their part of the 30 Years' War, they were put under they were really repressed by the Holy Roman Empire for a long, long time. And so there's a sort of ingrained dislike for Christianity in the form of Roman Catholicism among the people. At the same time, the Roman Catholic Church is the church in their mind. They view the Roman Catholic Church as the church. And so Lutheranism, I think, has a nice place in among these people, in that we have a liturgy like the Roman Catholic Church. We have a purified version of the Roman Catholic liturgy, which is very gospel-oriented and so forth. And so we look like the church, but we don't act like the church, at least in their experience. The gospel predominates among us as opposed to the law and so on. So I think that's one thing that's important to get through to the people. I think, well, just from seeing the sort of the problems that some of the sects are having as they go into this country, not having any connection with the country, that's an important point for us, because Czech people seem to have a good grasp of their own history, and if you're part of that history, you're sort of viewed as, okay, we'll give you a hearing.
So have the sects, or even non-Christian cults, have they managed to get a foothold in the Czech Republic?
Not so much. I mean, obviously they're there. The Mormons and Jehovah Witnesses are certainly there. The Jehovah Witnesses had a little bit more success than the Mormons, because Jehovah's came in before communists ended, and a few of their people were martyred. And, you know, martyrs tend to help any movement, really. But the Mormons have had pretty poor success there, and most people tend to sort of not like them. Another thing is that Czechs really don't like to be bothered. You have to create a forum to meet with them. Hello?
Yeah, we can still hear you.
Oh, sorry. I thought I lost you. The Czechs really don't like to have they don't like to be confronted by people. They need to have some kind of forum created for them so that they come there to listen to you. In other words, they don't like to be they don't like the sort of door-to-door approach of the cults that come around.
Our call-in numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Talking with Pastor Jim Krikova about Christianity in the Czech Republic. Harold is calling from St. Charles. Harold, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yes, you know, in the Missouri Senate, most of our Slavic membership background is Slovak. And I know one of the professors several years ago from the seminary here, Dr. Daniels. I know my brother had some conversation with him, and I think he's still over there. And, you know, we had the Slovak Senate here, and then there's now the Slovak District there. Has the pastor ever spent any time over in the Slovak Republic?
Actually, yes, I have. I actually know David Daniel. I've met him with him a couple of times over in Bratislava, which is in Slovakia. Part of the reason why we're not working in Slovakia is that there is a fairly active Lutheran church there. And so it's not, in a way, direct mission work isn't so necessary there. Certainly there are some helping groups over there in Slovakia that are helping to support schools and stuff like that. David Daniel, by the way, who is from the Slovak district of the Missouri Synod, it used to be the Slovak Synod. He's probably the world leading authority on Slovak Lutheranism. Just to give you a little background, though, on that, there was a Czech. He was actually from Silesia, which is kind of today it's part of the Czech Republic. But it was a guy by the name of Jiří Tchanovský, which is a kind of a difficult name to say. It's in the hymn book under Juraj Tchanovský. And he was a hymn writer, but he was a student at Wittenberg right around 1600 or a little bit after 1600. And he studied in Wittenberg under the sort of, I mean, obviously after Luther, because Luther died in 1546. And he brought Lutheranism back to the Czech people. But, of course, in 1620, the Czechs were chased out at the end of the 30 Years' War, and so they fled, and they fled into the forest. Well, the forest in those days was Slovakia, or what is Slovakia today. And so Lutheranism kind of was chased out of Bohemia and fled over to Slovakia, and that's why there's such a big Lutheran church in Slovakia today.
A couple final questions here. What's the economy, the social fabric, like in the Czech Republic?
Well, I would say it's pretty good. It's pretty good compared to other places. It's certainly better than in Slovakia, and it's a lot better than, say, like Ukraine, which is the next step over to the east. They're a member of the European Union, and they don't use the euro yet, but their currency is tied to the euro. And I would say that over the last 15 years, they've made giant strides forward in their economy. When I went there, it was really bad. It was really kind of depressing and difficult to live. But by this time now, it's really quite good.
Did the time of the communist produce a generation, as it did so many places elsewhere in Europe, especially Eastern Europe and Russia, a generation of adults who just became almost deeply nihilistic, and only their kids really are willing now to hear the message of the gospel?
I would say that's somewhat true. It's worse over in Russia, because don't forget Russia has been under communism a lot longer since the Russian Revolution, and that's what 1917, and so you don't have anybody alive today who lived during democracy. Whereas in the Czech Republic, which was under communism for 40 years, you still have some old people who remember democracy between World War I and World War II, or between World War I and when Hitler invaded them in 1936. And so basically you have some people who know what real, true democracy is, and those people who are actually alive pass that on to their children, who are in their 50s today, and that generation knows what democracy is, and they kind of have a little bit better idea of what to be doing, and that's why I think they're far ahead of the game.
Finally, with just a minute, tell us about Four Corners Mission Outreach and how our listeners can find out more about it.
Okay. Well, Four Corners Missions is an independent mission society, and we all of our members, our board members, are from the Evangelical Lutheran Synod, which is the old Norwegian Synod, which also was part of that group called the Missouri Synod and the Slovak Synod and the Wisconsin Synod and the Norwegian Synod. So that's who we are, part of the ELS. And we're an independent mission society from that church grouping. Our contact address is Four Corners Missions, P.O. Box 1695, Brewster, B-R-E-W-S-T-E-R, Massachusetts, 02631. And that mission society runs our work in the Czech Republic. It's it's made up. We have a board of directors of four people.
Just so our listeners don't avoid any confusion, the ELS, the Evangelical Lutheran Synod, is not the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. They
right.
sound a little similar, but they are theologically quite different. We're talking here in the case of the ELS about a confessional church body. Pastor Jim Krikova is the first Lutheran missionary sent to the former Iron Curtain country of the Czech Republic in 1990. He's director of Four Corners Missions. Pastor Krikova, thank you for being our guest.
My pleasure. Thanks for asking me.
You know, the mission work that is that's being done when the door opened, we talk about the wall falling, but the wall fell and the door opened, is absolutely necessary. In some places, communism, while Christianity in pockets thrived under communism, in some places it practically extinguished the light of the gospel. And where the light remains, where the light did remain, the opportunity remains, and where the light was extinguished, the opportunity is even greater. Think about Four Corners Missions. I'll give that address again, P.O. Box 1695, Brewster, Massachusetts, 02631. It's Four Corners Missions. And it's an outreach of the Evangelical Lutheran Synod, as I mentioned before, not the ELCA. When we come back from this break, we're going to turn from the subject of missions in the last half hour of the program to stem cell research. Steve Wagner of Stand to Reason is going to join us. We're going to respond to several things in the news lately about stem cell research. First of all, California, $3 billion in a public referendum of state money voted to go toward stem cell research, making California the leader financially in promoting, at least officially at the statewide level, embryonic stem cell research. So why does it appear so little has happened in California on stem cell research? Also, there have been fraud allegations surrounding stem cell research in South Korea. Some very odd stuff, and in fact, the researcher in question, the South Korean researcher in question, has withdrawn his initial paper on this. He says he's going to resubmit it once he irons out some of his ethical problems, and then we'll also talk about Senator Jack Danforth recently appearing in the media saying that the stem cell initiative here in Missouri is actually pro-life. We'll find out whether that's true after this.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.